dear. Okay, let me see. I will put it in the chat. All right. So Kaz Funahashi says in his glossary, so Ka is the first character of the name and Jo is the second. Ka means house, home, family. And Jo means common, usual, normal, regular. And Nishijima and Cross explain Jo means usual or everyday. So Nierman, the translation that I just linked to, he says Kajo literally means what is habitual, Jo, in one's home life, Ka. Throughout the discourse, Dogen speaks of Sahan, literally tea and cooked rice, as the staples of everyday living. And Nierman also says, taking tea and eating rice is a metaphor for partaking of the Dharma, which spiritually nourishes us. So throughout this chapter, Dogen mentions eating rice and drinking tea over and over. So we might then, based on what Nierman is saying, read this fascicle and think, okay, well, every time we read tea and rice and tea, we think, okay, Dharma, right? So this is the spiritual nourishment, and tea and rice stands for the Dharma. And that to a certain extent is accurate, but Dogen never uses metaphors in that simple a way. that is the case, but so we might think that, you know, he never means tea and rice literally, but I think he does. I think he means both. He's almost always speaking on multiple levels. So at a certain level, you know, tea and rice stand for the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors, our spiritual nourishment. And to some extent, it means tea and rice. So we'll explore that more. Now, Nishijima and Cross, in their intro, say of Kajo, and there's a four-volume Shobogenzo translated by Nishijima and Cross. And I love to have it around because their translations they're often kind of awkward and kind of intellectual, but I like them because not that I speak Japanese or actually the old Japanese that Dogen wrote in, but what I've heard is that it's more literal. So they do less interpretation for you and then there's a lot of really great footnotes. So Nishijima and Cross say of this everyday activity essay, people are often prone to think that religious matters should be different from daily life, being more sacred than and superior to daily life. But according to Buddhist theory, Buddhist life is nothing other than our daily life. Without daily life, there can never be Buddhism. In China, it was said that wearing clothes and eating meals are just Buddhism. In this chapter, Master Dogen explains the meaning of Kajo, everyday life, on the basis of Buddhism. So as we dive in, we should be open to the multiple layers of meaning. And I was thinking about this today during Zazen, sorry. That this is like, so I can imagine everybody's different. I can imagine some people leaving this Dharma talk thinking like, oh, you know, I don't really like Dharma talks that are just intellectual, right? Academic, studying texts, whatever. But I guess I would suggest that you look at this as like a workout for the mind. Just the way that your body, you know, you exercise in order to maintain strength and flexibility and health. that this is like exercise for your mind. It's not about understanding something, achieving something, leaving something. Like just when you exercise, you're rarely like, oh, I accomplished that. You're just for the doing it for the sake of itself. So whatever it is that we think about when we think, oh, the everyday activity relative to the Dharma, right? Everyday activity relative to the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors. Whatever we think about that going in, if you allow it, it's bound to be kind of challenged and stretched and turned upside down and expanded by Dogen's exploration. And I also sometimes you can think of, not so much in the part that I'm going to share today, but sometimes Dogen's writing is kind of like poetry in that it, again, it's not a prose description of something that you go, oh, I understand what he's talking about. It's more evocative, and you have to kind of trust what it is that it's bringing up in you. So the translation, when I read something, this is from the Kaz Ta-Nehisi. This is in Moon and a Dewdrop by Kaz Ta-Nehisi, but it's also in his it's in his giant Shobo Genzo as well, which I only have on Kindle. It's from him, but you have the link to the other translation. So Dogen starts in the domain of Buddha ancestors. Drinking tea and eating rice are everyday activity. Drinking tea and eating rice have been transmitted for a long time and are present right now. Thus, the Buddha ancestors' vital activity of drinking tea and eating rice comes to us. So, the gist of this is fairly simple. Zen is a lineage tradition. So something that is verified in each generation and then passed down from teacher to student, passed from person to person, that is what defines legitimacy in our tradition. So, and the longer that it's been passed on, the more legitimate it's held to be, because it's been verified, not just because it's old, but because it's been verified by so many people. So basically, like when Dogen or other authors say, and this has been transmitted down through the generations, like it means this is important. This is legitimate and important. Pay attention. And it does say the activity of drinking rice, drinking tea, and eating rice is vital to the way of the Buddha ancestors. So the Buddha ancestors are just those people in the past or the present who have awakened to, they manifest what it is we want. However that manifests for us, some liberation or ease, ease from anxiety, greater compassion, groundedness, whatever it is that your calls to your heart. These are people that have more of that than you do, and you want some of that. So somehow this drinking tea and eating rice is an important part of it. So then Dogen shares a traditional Zen story or koan. And I'm going to share, read the koan and Dogen's brief commentary on it, and then explore it line by line. And this is all the further in the text that I get today. So just to warn you. So priest Dao Kai, who would later become abbot of Mount Dayang, asked Taoji, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Taoji, it is said that the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are everyday tea and rice. Besides this, are there any words or phrasings for teaching? Taoji said, this is the teacher responding. So Dao Kai is the student, is the monk coming to ask this question. So the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are everyday tea and rice. Besides this, are there any words or phrases for teaching? Taoji says, tell me, when the emperor issues a decree in his territory, does he depend on ancient emperors Yu, Tang, Yao, or Shun? As Dao Kai was about to open his mouth, Tao Zhi covered it with his whisk, the ceremonial fly whisk. While you were thinking, you've already received 30 blows. Dao Kai was then awakened. He bowed deeply and began to leave. Tao Zhi said, "Wait, Reverend." Dao Kai did not turn around. And Tao Zhi said, "Have you reached the ground of no doubt?" Dao Kai covered his ears with his hands and left. So Dogen says, "From this, clearly understand that the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are their everyday tea and rice. Ordinary coarse tea and plain rice are Buddha's thoughts, ancestors' phrases. Because Buddha ancestors prepare tea and rice maintain Buddha ancestors. Accordingly, they need no powers other than this tea and rice, and they have no need to use powers as Buddha ancestors. Investigate and study the expression. Does he depend on emperors Yu, Tang, Yao, or Shun? Leap over the summit of the question. Besides this, are there any words or phrases for teaching? Try to see whether leaping is possible or not." So, if you're anything like me, part of you starts to shut down when you hear these koan stories, this inscrutable, you don't know what they're talking about, and the response doesn't seem to follow, and people don't say anything, and they put their hands over their ears, and they leave, and it's true that this isn't immediately accessible most of the time, but it can be worth exploring, which is what I'm going to try to demonstrate today. So like Dogen says at the end, he says, investigate and study the expression. What did Tao Zhi mean? Leap over the summit of the question. You know what? Exploring this. So to start at the top then, it is said that the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are everyday tea and rice. So what does this mean? And again, it's not, what did Dogen mean? We don't know that. So that's kind of like how this is similar to studying poetry, right? You explore it, you wrestle with it, but you don't like, pretty much, you know, sometimes it's helpful to know the context of the poet and maybe there's some established metaphors or something like that. But for the most part, you're supposed to relate to the words yourself and see what they evoke. So thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors. So these are the Buddhist and Zen teachings, right? The practices that we have found so useful and inspiring as we live our lives. What we, the Dharma, that's what we're here for. That's what we come together to spend some time exploring. So far so good. Everyday tea and rice. So Nirman says, these are the staples of everyday living. So for us, it might be coffee and pasta. And it's not just what we eat, you know, water, heat, clothing, money to pay the bills. It's our everyday, the staples of our everyday life. So what does it mean when we say the Dharma is a staple of everyday living? So I just came up with a short list. It's necessary. So many of us would probably agree, right? That the Dharma, the teachings, the practices have become necessary for us to live a healthy, fulfilling life. The need for the Dharma is built into us, inherent in our makeup, like the need for food and shelter. I think this is an interesting one that these other things, of course, we're going to say we need them. We need them to survive, or at least not to be really miserable. And in that sense, part, you know, just part of who we are needs spiritual food. So our spiritual needs are not either a weakness or a virtue. They're just part of being human. The Dharma is our basic sustaining spiritual food, not something extra like dessert. Another aspect of it. They're like tea and rice. They're not, they're our daily sustenance. And is there something more subtle being said here? So our everyday activities are something we tend to take for granted. That we tend to dismiss them as not being special. I have to go to the grocery store, whatever. They're things that we just get out of the way, not particularly worth our attention, unless we happen to find them pleasurable. But a lot of those everyday activities are not, you know, we're just like, whatever. And if the Dharma is not fundamentally different than those activities, so what is it? There's a specialness that we attribute to the Dharma and to practice that is an error? Or is it that our attitude toward our everyday activities is an error? That we don't recognize the specialness in our everyday activities? But I would say probably both. And so that's just the first line of the koan. So the next one, priest Dokai, Daokai, he's come to ask this teacher a question. It is said that the thoughts and words of Buddha ancestors are everyday tea and rice. Besides this, are there any words or phrases for the teaching? So this, what is Dokai wondering about? Now, the questions in Zen literature, particularly in these koan interactions, are not intellectual exercises. It isn't about a smart student wandering around, showing off, testing teachers to see how knowledgeable or witty they are, or even showing how insufficient their knowledge is and please, teacher, you know, instill your great wisdom in me by answering my question. So that's not what it's about. So we try to put ourselves in Daokai's place. So we've been taught this thing about the Dharma being basic spiritual sustenance for human beings, that we're meant to take it in and practice it regularly in a way that becomes habitual every day, just like the way we eat and cook and clean. You know, don't get excited about it. Don't think it's special. It's just part of everyday activity. And I can imagine Daokai saying, is that it? Okay. All right. You know, I sit most days of the week and I go to, you know, I try to make it to one or two Sangha meetings a week and think about the precepts. And at first that can be exciting, right? And then year after year, I don't know, are you supposed to make any progress? Do you make any progress? I don't know, maybe, maybe not. After a while, it's just kind of mundane and rote, right? Is that it? Do we just let the Dharma become a mundane part of our life and stop hoping for anything special? What about the fact that we become numb to and dismissive of stuff that gets too mundane every day? What about those peak moments we've experienced in our lives? Certain moments where we just had got a bigger perspective that temporarily set us free, inspired us, filled us with wonder and gratitude. So this is what I'm imagining. I don't know, right? But Daokai saying, okay, is this it? So it's just everyday activity. So how does Taoji answer? He says, tell me, when the emperor issues a decree in his territory, does he depend upon ancient emperors Yu, Tang, Yao, or Shun? So this is, you know, one situation where a little bit of knowledge about the words helps. So these are legendary Chinese emperors. So I read this as the question. If the emperor of Dao Kai and Taoji's time could only issue a decree if it seemed appropriate based on the decisions of his predecessors, can he be said to be an emperor, a completely autonomous leader with no limits on his power? If he's caught wondering what these legendary emperors would have done. So like the emperor hesitating as he ponders what the great legendary emperors would do, perhaps Dao Kai is hesitating, wondering what the Buddha ancestors would do. What do they know that he doesn't know? What is the right way to engage the Dharma? What is the right way to live? Tell me, where can I find it in the sutras? Are there any other teachings I haven't heard that will clarify this for me so I know what's right? So Dao Kai tries to answer Taozi's question, the emperor question, but Taozi stops him, covering the student's mouth with his ceremonial whisk. He says, while you were thinking, you've already received 30 blows. So traditionally, a student receives blows, right? If they're an apprentice, for instance, when she or he does something wrong. On the other hand, in Zen, we talk about aspiring to be a student worthy of being beaten. So I don't know if you've heard this one before. But in a sense, that is, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, that if you're not making mistakes, you're not really putting yourself out there and trying. So in a way, you are exposing yourself. And anybody who has participated in, you know, one of our ceremonies, Mondo, where you present a verse and people question you, or when you walk up in the center of the room and you ask the teacher a question in front of other people or something, to ask a question, to present ourselves as a student, takes courage, right? It's exposing ourselves and our what we're wondering about, what we're working with, what we care about, and saying we don't have it all figured out. So in a sense, doing that, you're going to make a mistake, right? But that doesn't mean you shouldn't have done it. It doesn't mean that was wrong. That's actually a good thing. So if the student steps forward and they get, you know, some blows, it's all the way that it was supposed to happen. So, and these physical interruptions of verbal dialogues are common in koan stories. You know, somebody hits somebody else upside the head or puts a sandal on their head or picks up a tile and starts to pretend to polish it or something like that. And they may seem rather random or inscrutable or, I don't know, theatrical. But if you think about how sometimes a physical act can bring you back into your body, can bring you back to the present moment. So say you're arguing with somebody and they just come over and just give you a hug. Or you're anxiously worrying about something and a friend, you know, comes over and puts a mug of tea mindfully into your hand and closes your hand around it and encourages you to take a sip. You know, sometimes that kind of interruption changes, you know, it stops the way that the mind was going. So how can Dao Kai answer Dao Kai and Taoji, probably Taoji, in a way that demonstrates not an intellectual understanding, but taking the next step on his spiritual personal journey. So according to the koan story, as Taoji prevents Daokai from giving a verbal explanation of his understanding, it says Daokai then awakened, right? Okay, so this is also something you find in koan stories frequently. So Daokai then awakened. So I think it's best if we set aside any idea that, like, now he awakened with a capital A, and before that he was clueless and lame, and now he's got it all figured out and he's going to be saintly and life won't trouble him anymore, and he's entered the, you know, he's now part of the club of people who understand. So that, you know, letting aside that kind of dualistic idea of awakening, what kind of awakening or opening might Daokai have had at this moment? So I'm just guessing. So if this exchange means Daokai was looking outside himself for affirmation, you know, what did the Buddha and the ancestors say? Is there any other teaching? What should I do? How should I be living? Is this enough, the way that I'm engaging the Dharma? I'm just picturing. So he knew the teachings. He knew the Dharma isn't special, but it is special. He knew that everything we're looking for is right here, but you still have to practice. Not being able to figure it out, not being able to come to a conclusion, Daokai comes to ask for help. And he steps forward with courage. So maybe at this moment of awakening, maybe he just thinks about waking up in the morning and opening his eyes and stretching and getting dressed and washing his face and kind of stumbling toward the zendo and sitting down on his meditation cushion and just that. Or maybe he comes home to his body right there, standing in the meditation hall, you know, with his vulnerability, his longing to know, asking the teacher a question, kind of just sees it all, that mundane situation, that situation of everyday activity that we tend to dismiss. And that maybe at that moment he could just see the Dharma revealed in its entirety, just in that activity. And so, yes, indeed, this is it. But what is the nature of this is it, right? So it's never that simple. It's never just like, well, Daokai didn't understand that everyday activity can be the Dharma. Like, okay. I mean, it's a real, each of us has to struggle with this, right? This is just a window onto somebody else's process. What is our question? What is our question about our everyday life? In what way do we dismiss it and not see it as the tea and rice of the Buddhas and ancestors? So just to finish this little go on part, it then says he was awakened. So Daokai, then he's going to bow deeply and begin to leave. So Tozier says, "Wait, Reverend." Daokai did not turn around. And Tozier said, "If have you reached the ground of no doubt?" Daokai covered his ears with his hands and left. So Daokai doesn't have to prove anything to anyone, not even to the teacher. There's a, something has been resolved in him that, you know, words can't express it anyway. He feels better. Something was okay. Something is resolved. But I'm guessing that Taozhi can see this, like, right? Like, when a person is more at home with themselves, more at peace, they just carry themselves differently. So I'm guessing that when Daokai walked out of that room, he did so differently than when he walked in. So Dogen's comments on this koan, and this is from the Nierman translation, which you have the link to. I really liked it. So he said, "So clearly we should preserve and take care of the teaching that the thoughts and sayings of the Buddhas and ancestors are the tea and rice of everyday life. The homely fare of everyday life is the thoughts of Buddhas and the sayings of ancestors. The Buddhas and ancestors prepare the tea and rice, and the tea and rice help sustain and take care of the Buddhas and ancestors. Since this is so, We, for our part, do not need to rely on anything apart from the potency of this tea and rice of theirs. Simply, we do not squander the strength of the Buddhas and ancestors that resides within this partaking of this tea and rice. So Nierman says in a footnote, homely fare is a Chinese term, literally coarse tea and thin gruel. He says is a conventional Chinese phrase used by a host as an apology for what is being offered a guest. So is the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors is homely fare. The homely fare of everyday life is the thoughts of Buddhas and sayings of ancestors. And this is where that kind of poetic thing is, right? The homely fare of everyday life. I think we all know what that means. Like, yeah, the homely fare of everyday life. Sometimes life is great and sweet and beautiful, and but it comes and it goes. It's not a graspable thing. You can't draw any conclusions. So overall, it seems very mundane compared to, you know, fairy tales and movies and what we imagined the lives of the saints might have been like. But what does it mean to not squander the strength of the Buddhas and ancestors that resides within the partaking of this tea and rice? So similarly, that kind of poetic image, to not squander it. And I feel like that is the take-home teaching for this portion of the everyday activity fascicle. You know, what does it mean to not squander this opportunity? Any way that I describe it will only suffice for me at a particular time, right? But I know what it feels like to squander this tea and rice, to squander the energy of the Buddhas and ancestors. I know what it's like to be ambivalent about this homely, the homely fare of everyday life and not recognize it for what it is. So I will leave it there. And any thoughts or questions, go ahead and raise your hand electronically or just unmute yourself or whatever. What does it mean to squander? Peter.
Thank you, Domyo. I just want to bring up Fred Rogers, whom my mother took me out of school early to see his show. He didn't squander the daily.
I'm tempted to cover my ears and turn off the computer.
Well, yeah, that's this thing about like wrestling with this as exercise for the mind. And I like to think that, you know, our study of teachings and texts is always in Buddhism is always about, it's not about acquiring any new ideas. It's about challenging the ideas that we already have, usually without even realizing it. So it's like expanding and challenging the mind, but then, you know, then you move on, right? You do your exercise and you don't carry the weights around all day. You just do the exercise and okay, there we go. Let go. Who cares? in one ear and out the other. Ken.
Thank you. You said something that struck a chord with me about, I don't remember what you said, but struck a chord, about pushing and making mistakes and having that be part of daily practice or this day-to-day tea and rice kind of behavior, I think, if I'm understanding correctly. And I find great comfort in that because I'm very humble and like in my ignorance and learning curve, and I don't know. I mean, there's no comparing one person's learning curve to where one person is to another necessarily, but it makes me feel comfort to know that I can put my foot I can put my Dharma foot in my mouth and then move on and be okay with it and hopefully expand a little bit. Can you re-say what you said about that so I can solidify it, because it's fading on me.
I think other people might remember, but I might have been talking about the scenario of this student stepping forward and kind of revealing the limitation in his understanding and, you know, receiving blows, but that's you're supposed to do that. Like receiving the blows is part of that process. I mean, if you just hung out on the sidelines because you're like, well, I know my understanding is limited, but if I go up there, I'm going to get some blows, then you're not going to learn anything, right? And you're not going to, and nobody's going to get to know you, and nobody's going to be able to help you because they don't know you, and they don't know what your limitations or strengths are. And I don't know. So that's why we step forward.
Of those today, so that makes me feel good.
let's see. So I got a question in the chat. Said teachers talk about certain practices being dangerous. What does that mean? How can anything in the Dharma be dangerous? Like no mind, for example, but isn't that just another experience? I don't know. I guess when I think about the Dharma teachings and practices, I guess I always think of them as a kind of medicine for a particular ill. So, just like in physical stuff, there, if you take the wrong medicine, it could actually be harmful, not what you actually need. So for example, you know, the kind of study, the, you know, delving into a text that we did today, you know, I think for many of us it's fruitful, and particularly, unfortunately, I would say if you have any resistance to it, it's probably fruitful. But if you are somebody who just like loves to get really intellectual about stuff and read stuff and look for the answers and pile up books and philosophize and analyze and, you know, then at a certain point, textual study might not be the right medicine for you, right? It might be, you might be, do something else, like don't read anything for a whole year or something like that. That might be the right medicine at a certain point. And there are teachings that can be just, I guess, just misunderstood. You know, if we don't, we don't explore things and have checks and balances, this is where teachers and Sangha come in as well. For instance, I think maybe the practice of giving students blows is probably a potentially dangerous one. Even talking about that, right? It's implication that somehow the teacher has this superior position and can, I don't know, somehow rain abuse upon a student. And, you know, there's certainly teachers in the past who have gone too far with that idea of superiority or being beyond reproach. And I guess I would call that dangerous. So I'm not sure if that answered the question, but Alice.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I'm wondering whether the 30 blows that they meant was the 30 blows that you have when you feel guilty. Mm. You know, so he made that saying like, when the emperor passes a decree, does he not depend on, you know, previous rulers? And then I think maybe he realized that it's just words. You need to apply the words into your daily practice with your rice and your tea. It's the application of those words that really transmit your learning of the Dharma, if that makes sense. Mm. And then when he heard that correction, he felt 30 blows of guilt.
So they were kind of self-delivered blows in a way.
I just messed up 30 times, you know, kind of thing.
Interesting, because they didn't say the teacher gave him blows. The teacher said, as soon as you started to answer, you received 30 blows. Interesting.
I feel that way sometimes when I like finally learn something and I go, oh. And then, you know, I feel the feeling of 30 blows that I've never experienced before, but has just come all in one big slap because I just realized something.
I like it.
I have a comment about the homely fare and wandering. To me, that meant, you know, mundane activities, like say every day I go for a walk around the park, and it could be boring, but I try not to squander that activity by taking it for granted. It is homely fare in the sense that I do it every day and it could become routine, but I try to see it in a fresh way every time. And thereby I'm not squandering that activity. Is that close?
Sounds like it to me. Yeah, and I almost like the homely fare, I mean, if it's correct and there's this sense that this is something you might say like, oh, I just have this, all I have to feed you is this homely fare, you know, it's kind of disparaging in a way that, you know, it's just homely fare. But, you know, we're saying that hey, that rice and that tea is what sustains us. Let's see. Katie, did you want to try your microphone?
Yeah, can he hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was thinking, this is something I've been thinking about in other contexts too, so it could be that it just popped up. But it seems like, you know, there's a lot of about our ancestors and our teachers that nowadays we're all kind of saying, oh, they had slaves. Or in this case, like I think of the Zen teachers, there's a lot, they're all men and they're hitting people. And so I'm like, I find that kind of appalling. And so I'll sometimes, and also the Zen story form, like, I'm kind of glad you said what you said about that. Cause I, I'll find myself kind of rolling my eyes like, oh my God, they're doing this again. And, but I mean, there's just so much wonderfulness about the Dharma. And I just think that I have to remind myself, you know, to have discernment around taking it in rather than getting caught up in the other parts of it that I don't like particularly. And I don't know if other people have that, but it is sort of the meat and not meat and potatoes. It is the rice and tea of our practice. And it's like, I struggle with that. That's a thing that I'm trying to figure out. And I mean, it relates to also to like the United States, you know, has that same thing going on. So, I mean, it's like every tradition has these parts of it and how to. So I'm not sure if that's exactly what he's trying to say, but that's what came up in me. Mm. So.
Well, I think that's why I like to, I mean, I don't mean to be disparaging about New Age stuff. I mean, maybe people here have New Age things that you do. But to me, like, oftentimes what New Age refers to is somebody has picked and chosen from things and assembled a palatable practice or a palatable philosophy. So it's the affirming, accessible stuff. So it's like, to some extent you could say it's like, you know, let's jettison some of this old crap that's not necessary, but then how do you know? And if we just do it on the basis of our preference, then a lot of times we don't end up encountering something that ends up being very useful and challenging. So that is one of the things I'd like about being part of a whole tradition, because then it's like, I don't really like that, but I don't know, maybe there's something there. And sometimes there's not, you know, but yeah, I've found that usually if I look more closely, there's a little something there. So it is 12:15. I would love to go on longer, but I'll wrap it up with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. So what do you think? Should I continue with everyday activities someday? Not like next week, but a month from now? Okay. Have a good one. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Damo. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Damo. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for being here.